You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 26th of May. We started our programme today with a discussion around the four-day work week. It's nearly 6 months since the policy for the public sector workers started here in the UAE, and now the strategy has come up as a topic at the World Economic Forum in Davos in Switzerland. Her Excellency Ohoud Al-Rumi, the UAE's Minister of State for Government Development and the Future, recommended the policy. And we opened up the phone lines to find out how many people are indeed only doing a 4 or a 4.5 day week. We also discussed the increase in road accidents in the UAE and what insurance companies are doing to encourage us to drive more carefully. Robbie Greenfield joined us for a sports update, and we also heard from Richard Dean because he was live in Doha for an announcement from Qatar Airways, who said that they're going to work with GCC Airlines, including Fly Dubai, to bring thousands of fans into Doha for the FIFA World Cup in November. We heard from Qatar Airways Group CEO Akbar Al-Bakr and also Fly Dubai CEO Gaith Al-Gaith. Plus, Vinayak Mitani, the CEO of B&B Me Holiday Homes, told us he's already seeing bookings for the World Cup. Plus, we also spoke to one of the victims of the gas blast in Abu Dhabi and found out why mobile phones are changing the shape of our bodies. That's with our tech correspondent, Kevin Sebastian.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Richard Dean is in Qatar today for a big announcement about the FIFA World Cup. Now, there was a lot of secrecy around this trip. At first, on the Business Breakfast, they sort of attempted to not say where he was going. But unfortunately, Tom Urquhart quite quickly let the cat out of the bag, probably because he, more than anyone else on the Breakfast team, is very excited about the FIFA World Cup. Now, Richard has just landed in Doha ahead of that big announcement that we still don't quite know what it's about. And he has sent us through this message.
Hey, George. So just landed at Doha Airport in Qatar. So here's the deal. Here's what we know so far. I flew here with Fly Dubai, and it's basically about the Football World Cup and logistics and getting people, humans, into Doha, into Qatar for the busy part of the World Cup. Because here's the thing. If you think about a Football World Cup, and you don't very often, I know I get there, but I do. It's a one-month event. The first 2 weeks are really, really busy with loads of games. And then when you get towards the end and the semi-finals and the final, there's very few games and very few people. But the first two and a half weeks, there's so much football happening, 2-3 games a day. You think about it, 60, 70,000 people per stadium. You know, you're talking millions of people in a week coming into Doha. So the deal is, it's one city. Okay, normally a World Cup would be in, I don't know, Germany, with loads of cities, of Frankfurt and Munich and Stuttgart and Hamburg. Qatar has one city, which is Doha. And therefore, they've realised, and this is what they've said, we're going to need people to stay in surrounding cities. We're going to need some people to stay in Muscat or in Riyadh or in Manama or, of course, in Abu Dhabi and Dubai, which is why Qatar Airways, clearly it's their gig, have teamed up with various different airlines around the region to provide these shuttle services in and out in a day. So you can stay in Kuwait City and then fly in the morning and watch, I don't know, Senegal against Uruguay, and then fly back to Kuwait City in the evening. Same with Dubai. And Fly Dubai is the airline that they've picked for this service. So we don't know much about it yet, but we know that there's some big hitters who are going to be speaking today. We know Akbar Al-Bakr, CEO of Qatar Airways, is going to be speaking because he's kind of running the whole shebang. And then you've got the CEOs of all these different airlines that are going to be part of it, like Gaith Al-Gaith from Fly Dubai, who we know well, the boss of Saudia in Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. So essentially, what we're talking about is the Football World Cup in Qatar happening in November and December this year. And it's about moving people, moving the supporters so they can get to the games. Yeah, sure, some of them are going to stay in Doha and they're going to love it. And it's going to be a great atmosphere, I'm sure. It always is at a World Cup. There's going to be fan zones and this and that and the other. but they can't all stay in Doha. So we're going to find out how this massive logistical operation of literally moving millions of people around the Gulf into and out of Doha on a daily or half-daily basis is going to work. And I'll have more details for you shortly. Cheers. Back to you in the studio in Dubai.
Thank you very much, Richard Dean. Very exciting stuff. We will be looking to hear from him later on in the programme. And we will be exploring how the FIFA World Cup in Qatar is going to boost tourism in the United Arab Emirates. We'll be speaking to a holiday rental company who can attest to it. They say they've already seen an uptick in bookings. And we will be hopefully getting the complete lowdown on that story, because we sort of know the hints, but we're not allowed to explain exactly what's happening yet. We've got to wait for the official announcement, and that should come in the next few minutes.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, welcome back. Have you heard that song before? Well, I can tell you now, you're going to get very used to hearing that song, because it is the theme song to the FIFA World Cup in Qatar. Now, Qatar Airways has announced that it is planning to work with GCC Airlines, including Fly Dubai, to bring thousands of fans into Doha for that FIFA World Cup in November. The scheme is called Match Day Shuttle Service. Now, here is Qatar Airways Group CEO Akbar Al Bakr making the big announcement. Now, the reason why we have this audio is because Richard Dean has flown to Doha today, and this information is literally breaking news. It is hot off the press.
It is my pleasure to announce that in cooperation with Fly Dubai, Kuwait Airways, Oman Air, and Saudia, we will be collectively hosting day-trip shuttle flights from Dubai, Jeddah, Kuwait City, Muscat, and Riyadh for fans who have secured their FIFA World Cup match tickets. Needless to say that there will also be additional flights by Air Arabia and Etihad when they choose to apply. This initiative will help truly make this tournament a World Cup for all, allowing us to share the business opportunities with various regional airline partners and also provide fans with a simple and convenient travel experience that minimizes logistical considerations. For fans throughout the region, will be able to come to Doha for their match day, enjoy the atmosphere and city, and still return on the same evening to their homes. Fans staying in Doha will be able to explore other parts of the Middle East for the day, bridging our cultures and showing them all that Arabian hospitality has to offer. To kick off this exciting partnership, starting soon, tickets for these match day shuttle flights will be available for this historic tournament, with multiple frequencies planned from Dubai, Jeddah, Kuwait City, Muscat, and Riyadh. These flights will be specially timed to allow a seamless experience for fans from start to finish, and with no luggage, they will be able to quickly start the day in Doha. Flights will be scheduled to arrive up to 5 hours before the match, so fans can enjoy the city without a rush. They can discover a range of activities from Visit Qatar and experience the great atmosphere of the world's biggest tournament. Then, after the games, fans will once again have plenty of time to travel through Doha before boarding their flights for home. Connecting fans and a shared love for football are at the heart of this game-changing partnership.
That is Qatar Airways Group CEO Akbar Al Bakr making that big announcement. The Qatar Airways has announced that it will work with GCC Airlines, including Fly Dubai, to bring in thousands of fans into Doha for that FIFA World Cup in November. He offered a few more details about the flights.
Fly Dubai will offer up to 60 daily flights with 30 rotations, bringing up to 2,500 fans per day. Kuwait Airways are set to operate a total of up to 20 flights per day with rotations. Oman Air will offer up to 48 daily flights with 24 rotations, bringing us 3,400 fans per day. We even have additional relationship developing between Oman Air and Oman Tourism to promote mutually destinations like we always do with our other partners. And lastly, Saudi will operate up to 40 daily flights between Riyadh and Jeddah with 20 rotations, flying up to 5,000 fans a day. This, of course, does not talk about the scheduled flights that these airlines will continue to fly out of Hamad International Airport. I want to make it very clear that all these shuttles for seamless travel experience will happen from Doha International Airport, which is fully furnished and ready to take these large volumes of people with seamless immigration experiences.
Wow, Fly Dubai to offer up to 60 daily flights with 30 rotations to Doha. That will enable the airline to bring up to 2,500 fans into Qatar for the football per day. They are promising a seamless immigration experience, as you just heard. Now, Fly Dubai CEO Gaith Al-Gaith has also been speaking at the press conference about this exciting partnership. Richard Dean is there and he sent us back this clip.
The convenience of these match day shuttle services will enable football fans to move freely and travel from the United Arab Emirates, enjoy the football match day in Doha, and return in the same day. We are dedicated to offering our passenger the best experience throughout their travel journey. To match the excitement, the stadium across Qatar, recognizing that this is a lifelong memory for all. We look forward to sharing more details about the Fly Dubai Match Day shuttle services soon. We are match day ready and counting down the days to welcome visitor and football fan from all over the world to Doha. Thank you very much.
So that is Fly Dubai CEO Gaith Al-Gaith speaking literally in the last few minutes at the press conference about this exciting partnership. Now, with 179 days to go before the big day, we are all, as you can imagine, getting incredibly excited about the FIFA World Cup. It is the first in the Arab world and the Middle East. We are going to try to grab Richard in a little bit of time to grab more details. He's in Doha at that press conference. The event, of course, this World Cup is expected to bring a huge boost to the tourism industries of Kuwait, Saudi, Oman, and of course, importantly, the United Arab Emirates. There'll be lots of people wanting to stay in Dubai and travel on a daily basis to Doha. And it looks like all of those accommodation options are being snapped up quickly by football fans, not just hotel rooms, also apartments and villas. And joining me on the line now to give us the lowdown on how busy they are looking for October is Vinayak Matani. He is the CEO of B&B Me Holiday Homes, and he joins me now on Microsoft Teams. Hi, Vinayak, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Very well indeed. Fantastic to have you on the line so that we can get your reaction to this breaking news. What do you reckon? Is it going to be a boost to the UAE's tourist sector?
Oh, for sure. It already is. I mean, we're so blessed to be in the area we are with just having come out of Expo, which was a massive boost, to now having the World Cup coming up. And I think the announcements just come out of Qatar a couple of hours back are just going to boost the travel here even more. I mean, Dubai is the place in the Middle East. And to have the World Cup only a 30, 40-minute flight away and have shuttle services going back and forth, this is Christmas already.
So you guys have posh holiday homes. They're sort of, you're the upscale holiday homes location. If people want to book via B&B Me Homes, are they proving popular with football fans? And where are these football fans from?
So we are having a huge demand. We have one of our penthouses booked out for the entire duration by a guest from Vancouver already.
Cool.
We have requests from the U.S. We have requests from India, and from Africa. I mean, it's all over the place. We're actually setting up a special travel desk within our business catering for the World Cup, where we're going to offer a full concierge service, including a private jet service, taking you from Dubai to Doha for the games, watch the games, a luxury car picks you up, takes you to the suite, you watch the game in a private box, and then it brings you back and you fly back by private jet and stay in one of our properties.
Do you think that Dubai and Abu Dhabi might sell out accommodation-wise during this period? What with all these, I mean, we've just heard that there will be, how many flights? 60 daily flights from Fly Dubai alone. I mean, you can imagine when Etihad and the Abu Dhabi crews get on side there, you could see even more flights on a daily basis from the UAE. It feels like the UAE could be the main hub for this World Cup.
Oh, there's no discussion about that. There's not a doubt in my mind that Dubai will be the main hub. In terms of filling out, I mean, generally at that time of the year, we're filled out anyway. So we're talking about excess demand over here. And we're hiring more business development members to ensure that we have enough supply and enough properties in our portfolio to service these guests. Now, you're going to get football fans from all over. Like you said, we are more of the upscale. So we are offering a full service to our guests that come and stay with us.
It's been, I mean, let's be honest, there's been hospitality and hotels and villas like you guys. You took a bit of a hit in 2020. Dubai did come back a lot faster than other countries. But still, you know, hospitality took a knock during the pandemic. Do you think that after Expo 2020 and then this World Cup, this could bring back everyone fighting, you know, not just the accommodation, not just the hotels, but also the extraneous services, you know, the balloon rides, the desert safaris, the restaurants?
Well, we're already seeing a lot of that happening. I mean, we set up a glamping business and the demand for glamping over the winter season has just been phenomenal. We have a supper club business running over the summer and that's been very successful as well. So I think it's only normal that people are coming to Dubai. You know, the restaurants get impacted. There's new restaurants opening up. The parks and resorts gets impacted. People want to go there. The beaches are great. You see so many beach clubs coming up in Dubai now. The desert safaris work very well. So, yeah, I think the additional parts of tourism is going to benefit out of this as well.
Does it mean that you can charge a premium? Is it time to cash in for hospitality and tourism bosses right now?
Look, we've had a very tough 2 years, and you know, pre-2020 average room rates in Dubai were the lowest they've ever been. This is an opportunity for rates to go up, and you know, unfortunately, that's the way the market works. Demand spurs price, and demand is definitely higher than supply at the moment.
Amazing to speak to you. And it's always great to hear about, you know, the businesses here in the UAE doing well, even if it does mean that the cost of hotel rooms are going up. It's fantastic to speak to you. Vinayak Mattani, CEO of B&B Me Holiday Homes. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure being here again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. And just to reiterate that breaking news that we've had just coming in, Qatar Airways has announced that it is working with GCC Airlines, including Fly Dubai, to bring thousands of fans into Doha for the FIFA World Cup in November. An absolutely extraordinary deal they've made there. If you think about what was happening just a couple of years ago here in the Middle East, there are 179 days to go before the big day. Fly Dubai CEO Gaith Al-Gaith speaking at the press conference in Doha. Zina managed to find that press conference live on YouTube, and as a consequence we got those clips literally as it was happening. But Fly Dubai will be offering up to 60 daily flights with 30 rotations, bringing up to 2,500 fans into Doha every single day. That is the most extraordinary teaming up session there, and certainly gives you the impression that Dubai and the UAE is going to be the centre of this FIFA World Cup, even if the football matches are actually going on in Doha.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Discussing the breaking news that Qatar Airways has announced that it's planning to work with GCC Airlines, including Fly Dubai, to bring thousands of fans into Doha for the FIFA World Cup in November. The scheme is called Match Day Shuttle Service. Richard Dean is at that press conference right now. He's been attending it while Zina Zalamea, our producer here, has been watching the press conference on YouTube. Now, Richard Dean had a question about the high Hayya card. The Hayya card is your entry payment to the state of Qatar and your stadium access along with the match ticket. International fans will also need to confirm their accommodation plans through this Hayya card. This was the question that Richard Dean asked Qatar Airways CEO Akbar Al-Bakr.
Mr. Al-Bakr and Mr. Al-Gaith, Richard Dean here, Dubai Eye Radio in the UAE. Lots of questions we're getting about the Hayya card, which follows on from your point about the fact that you need to have the necessary documentation. Do people need to have the Hayya card to use these flights? And to your point, Mr. Al-Bakr there, myself, as a resident of the United Arab Emirates, am I understanding it correctly? Can I not use these shuttle flights only for non-GCC residents? I'd like your appreciation. Thank you, sir.
No, this shuttle is for everybody that is resident in the GCC who will be using this shuttle coming to watch the match. And that is what the point that I had very clearly stated earlier. It doesn't stop anybody. It is not only for GCC. We don't discriminate of people who live in those countries. The shuttle flights are put there for spectators from those countries to come, watch the match, and go. Because, you know, like every country in the world, we are not unique, where accommodations will be in short supply. Because the volume in every FIFA, even if it is in a big country like South Africa, like Russia, like anywhere else, there has always been a shortage of accommodation. So we are not unique. The biggest challenge for us is because everything is happening in one place. So we are giving this facility for our airlines to be able to fly people in and out seamlessly who come to watch the FIFA World Cup as a domestic passenger.
That's our very own Richard Dean there, the Business Breakfast, Richard Dean, asking a question of Qatar Airways CEO Akbar Al-Bakr. He travelled to Doha today with Fly Dubai for that announcement. And as you can imagine, there will be plenty more on the Business Breakfast tomorrow morning. So nearly 6 months after the 4.5-day work week was introduced in the United Arab Emirates, the country's Minister of State for Government Development and the Future has praised the policy at the World Economic Forum. Her Excellency Ohoud Al-Rumi spoke on a high-level panel at the global conference, which is taking place this week in Davos in Switzerland. Now, the policy for public sector workers was introduced on January the 1st this year. This is Her Excellency speaking at the event.
I see more of the implementation around the world in the private sector rather than the governments. Mm. And I can understand that because governments usually are slow. They have rigid systems. In the UAE, I think we are creating the government of the future. We always push boundaries and we're not afraid of experimenting with new things. Maybe we are the first country in the world to institute the shorter work week government-wide, and employees are given the flexibility to work remotely or manage their working hours on flexi times. This decision was triggered by four reasons. First, enhancing the well-being. Second, strengthening the family bonds and the community relations, because people will have more time to take care of their families, whether men or women, and they will have more time for recreational activities. The third one is economic, because when people have a longer weekend, they can spend more, and this will benefit the local domestic sectors and also to better align with the global markets. But also, we were supported to move ahead.
Now, looking more widely, if a 4-day work week policy was to be successful, one of the panelists said it would need to be for everyone. That was the message from Jonas Prising. He's the chairman and CEO of Manpower Group, which is a workforce company that provides contingent and permanent staff.
This needs to be equitably distributed across many categories of workers, not only knowledge workers, not only those that can work from home, but people who are in production lines, who are driving trucks, who are in warehouses, who are in manufacturing. Otherwise, we'll have a bifurcation of the workforce and an unequitable distribution of this very valuable benefit, and that is truly something that all workers are looking for.
of course, that has been a slight cause for contention here in the United Arab Emirates, because while government workers and those working for some government organisations have indeed been given a 4 or 4.5 day working week, the private sector still does not seem to have followed suit, unless I'm wrong. If there are companies out there who are private and have introduced that policy, I would be delighted to hear from you if you're one of their employees or the employer. Please do get in touch, 4001, or you can use our WhatsApp number, which is 04871 5500. I'd love to hear from some employers who have introduced that 4.5 day working week, just to see whether or not it's worked, whether it's practicable from a point of view of getting the work done, and whether or not it's made your staff happier. Now, the idea of working fewer hours is not new, and that was pointed out by another one of the speakers on this panel, social entrepreneur Hilary Cottam OBE.
And one of the most interesting is Kellogg's in the 1930s. And what happened in the 1930s in Kellogg's is that Kellogg's, it was one of the biggest factories, the breakfast cereal, he offered his workers 6-hour shifts from 8 hours for exactly the same pay. And what happened was that people flocked to Kellogg's. Journalists, the administrators of the Hoover, the Hoover administrators, social scientists, there were amazing household studies of what happened, because everybody thought industrialization would lead to less work. Of course, Keynes was writing about how his grandchildren would have 15-hour days. And so what's really interesting is that at Kellogg's, productivity went up dramatically. Accidents went down, the economics of the company really changed, and people's lives improved. And when the kind of household studies people said that they had, quote, more life.
Indeed, more life. Well, you would have more of a life, wouldn't you, if you had Friday off as well. Now, some companies here in the UAE actually introduced the idea of a four and a half day working week ahead of the curve. One was Louis Samurai, who is the owner of Active PR. She introduced a 4 day working week in August, or rather he introduced a 4 day working week. So Friday, Saturday and Sunday were off. Now, he spoke to Helen Farmer when the company made that announcement.
What we've done is we've gone with a 4 day working week where we've extended the day by 1 hour, so half an hour earlier in the morning, half an hour later in the evening. And when we announced it as a team, they were just ecstatic. I mean, everyone is just absolutely over the moon. It's very, very rewarding to be able to give your teams who work very hard the ability to have an even better work-life balance.
Another PR company, Tish Tash, introduced a 4.5 day work week nearly a year ago now. Speaking to Helen Farmer in December, she said it was working out phenomenally.
Our aim was really about work-life balance, but true work-life balance. I think nobody these days has, a standard 9-to-5 jobs. Everyone's working crazy hours, long hours. And for us, it was really, we've always believed in flexible working. And I think this was another way of really highlighting the importance of giving people time and space to move away from work, to reflect on their week, to have time with their kids, to have time for themselves. And it really was for us about creating a dedicated time where we said to people, no, you cannot be on your phones, you cannot be at work, this is you time, and you need to take that time for your mental health. And that was the real reason that we did it. I mean, it did stem from COVID, obviously, because it was such a difficult time for a lot of people. But I think it was something that we would have moved to naturally anyway, as a next step in this kind of need for more flexible working globally.
Okay, so I sent a message out to a big group of my friends this morning saying, okay, tell me, do any of you know anyone who is only working 4.5 days a week? And two people got back in touch. One of them, their company finishes at bang on lunchtime on Friday without question. So they do get the 4.5 day working week. Of course, all the schools close at midday in Dubai on Friday, which causes a great deal of, let's just say, there's a certain amount of disgruntlement among the working parents that the children finish at lunchtime on a Friday. And then there's one other company, which is Majid Al Futtaim, which has apparently adopted that 4.5 day working week. But so far, it doesn't seem to have become widespread. And certainly, it doesn't sound like when the children are at home on Friday afternoon, so are their parents. Now, if I'm wrong, please do get in touch. 4001, join the conversation. That WhatsApp number is completely free and you can send voice messages as well at 0487155500. Now, one country which took the path of a four-day working week more than 7 days ago is Iceland. Now, their experiment started right back in 2017. They did a pilot study that lasted 4 years. And the success of the trial means that 86% of Iceland's workforce have now moved to shorter hours for the same pay or are shortly going to gain the right to do so. To find out more, I spoke to Guðmundur Haraldsson. He's a researcher from the UK think tank Autonomy and the Association for Sustainable Democracy in Iceland. He published his study entitled Going Public, Iceland's Journey to a Shorter Working Week in June last year. And this was his view on the four-day working week.
These are two trials, one initiated by the government and one initiated by Reykjavik City Council. Reykjavik is the largest municipality in Iceland. And the two trials started in 2015 and 2017 and grew to encompass over 2,500 workers in total. So that's more than 1% of the employment market. So it was a relatively large trial. The workers were given shorter hours without reduced pay. The reduction amounted to 1 to 4 hours a week.
I mean, realistically, that sounds amazing from a worker's point of view, to have your hours reduced, but your pay stay the same. I imagine the workers who took part in the survey were very enthusiastic.
Yes, people were very enthusiastic. The trials were popular, but they were also very successful in that people were able to reduce their hours without impacting the services being provided. And the trials are designed so that services would not be impacted. That was the whole aim, to be able to do these two things at the same time. Furthermore, during the trials, they were not supposed to cost the government of Reykjavik City directly. So the workplaces were not allowed to add more staff to be able to run the trials. So all of these factors came together. And I believe the reason this was successful was that we already had reached the technological states where we could actually achieve this, but we hadn't changed our working practices sufficiently. And I believe this applies to many workplaces around the world.
It's really interesting. You raised two points there. I'm very interested that it didn't have an impact on services. So which sections of the workplace took part in this trial? Because I can imagine there must be some services where you need people to be there Monday to Friday.
Correct. So these trials amounted to shorter hours either every day of the working week, or people received shorter hours once a week, once every 2 weeks, something like that. So there were different patterns fitting different workplaces. In some cases, shifts were rearranged so that people were able to leave earlier or arrive later for their shift. So that's how they got their shorter hours. So there were different methods for each workplace, and that's the key. It does not follow the same formula everywhere. There was dialogue in the workplaces.
And when you say it was an unqualified success, in what terms do you measure that success?
It was a successful trial because the same services were being provided at reduced hours without negatively impacting the quality of life of the workers. Indeed, the well-being and work-life balance both improved significantly. And if you have the same service being provided at less hours, you are increasing productivity. And interviews confirm this, both with managers and staff.
So what's so exciting about your survey is, first of all, that it took place back in 2015 to 2019, and that it's now been translated into real life in Iceland. Is that the case?
So the trials ran for a few years, and when they concluded, the unions and the Confederation of Unions signed new labor contracts, based the contracts partially on experience from these trials. And what they were able to do is to agree on shorter hours and follow the same principles as the trials generated, or the learnings from the trials. So they positively impacted contracts and translated into real life for people both in private and public sector.
So in some ways, I'm quite envious of these people who have managed to bring their week down from 40 hours to 36, because realistically, I work much longer hours than that. I'm not playing a violin about it. I enjoy my work, but I'm definitely working more than 40 hours. And that's because I need to. I can't imagine bringing it down. There must have been a mindset change for the people taking part in the survey as well, I guess.
Most probably, yes. Judging from interviews with staff, you can discern that there was a mindset change. There were comments about people being more on their toes about their hours, shortening meetings, ensuring that tasks were meaningful, to change protocols so that they could finish the tasks earlier, quicker, sometimes postponing tasks until the next day because they were not that important. So there was a change of emphasis from, you know, that the job is there to be done, but you can use different methods depending on the situation. And yes, there was also a technological aspect whereby new solutions were put in place to help in some places. So yes, there was probably a mindset change that people now have more emphasis on completing the work so that they can go back to their families.
Numerous articles about a shorter working week cite Iceland. They cite this study as a model for future behaviour. I think what's most extraordinary is that it works at all. I think before this research, it seems quite out there as a theory.
And probably before the trials, if you would ask people around here, they might have said the same. But because I've been working on this topic for a number of years, close to a decade now, people often were very skeptical about these ideas, you know. Can we really do this? And they did ask very good questions, but the trials actually generated answers to many of these questions and concerns and showed us that, yeah, we can do it in the 21st century. It requires kind of applying new methods and new patterns of thinking, but it is certainly possible.
That was workplace researcher Gudmundur Haraldsson from Iceland. And I want to know whether the new thinking has started in your workplace. Has your employer considered giving you a 4-day week or a 4.5-day week? So far, lots of messages coming in. So far, nobody is working a 4-day work week, which is very interesting.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now we're going to turn our attention to a breaking news story here in the United Arab Emirates. It's a story that we've been covering for the last week or so. It is monkeypox, because the first case, as I'm sure you know, was confirmed in the UAE on Tuesday. Last night, there was a press briefing by the Ministry of Health and Prevention, and the ARN News team were listening. And as a consequence, I invite the fabulous Nadia Swan into the studio. Hello.
Good morning, Georgia. Hi, how are you doing?
Very well indeed. Now, I know you guys have been busy out there. There's a lot going on. First up, the ministry actually said it was going to stop its regular COVID-19 briefings that we'd sort of got used to. First of all, they used to be every week. Then they went to every 2 weeks, and then they sort of petered out. And it's the end of an era.
That's right. So they've sort of made an announcement, really, to say that they're not going to have them on any regular basis, and they're just going to have them more on an ad hoc basis as and when there is news or instructions to share with the public. So what they're saying now is, in last night's press briefing, they said that the country is ready to deal with monkeypox. The spokesperson, Dr. Fatima Al-Attar, was calling on people to take the necessary precautions, even though the chances of that human-to-human transmission is relatively low. She was speaking through a translator. Here's what she had to say.
An important step is to maintain personal hygiene and not to exchange personal tools with others. And we recommend avoiding contact with any person who has skin rashes, and avoid contacting any specific tools of the infected person.
Meanwhile, in the UAE, there's residents who have been sharing their thoughts on monkeypox.
As a mother of two, I'm very, very much worried about this situation, because my little son, who is only 4 years old, had already had corona, adenovirus, and influenza A. I don't know what else he will get. I was thinking how I can build his immune system back and everything. Now it's monkeypox. I'm really worried.
Among concerned with the monkeypox thus far, I think the UAE does an amazing job being proactive to these kind of things. So judging from the COVID situation, I feel very relaxed, and I know that we'll get there in the end.
Now, as you know, we've been speaking to Dr. Richard Brennan. He is Regional Emergency Director of the World Health Organization. They confirmed that the UAE is the first country to have a confirmed case of monkeypox in this region. They call it the Eastern Mediterranean region, which comprises of 22 countries and territories in the Middle East, North Africa, the Horn of Africa, and Central Asia. Now, he told me that they're coordinating with these countries. They're stepping up surveillance and reporting. And I asked him why they there was so much focus on the disease now, considering really it's been endemic in Africa for years?
This is a very unusual outbreak. We haven't seen it so many countries impacted by monkeypox at the same time. Certainly we've had exported cases over the years, but this is unusual. We don't fully understand the reasons for it, but there are, as you can imagine, a lot of investigations going on to better understand why it's happened in this way, and also a lot of work being done to control the outbreak. We're confident that we'll be able to get on top of it.
I also asked him how the health authorities are dealing with people who have been classified as close contacts to somebody with monkeypox.
Just like we've done with COVID, that involves identifying close contacts and ensuring that they are in quarantine for, again, up to 3 weeks, with daily checking to see if they develop symptoms. The smallpox vaccine works effectively against monkeypox, and it can be used also primarily amongst contacts. We're not going to see mass vaccination campaigns like we've seen with COVID to control an outbreak of monkeypox. We do what's called ring vaccination. So that means vaccinating individual close contacts of confirmed cases. We're not going to see mass vaccination campaigns. We're not going to see the lockdowns or anything like that that we've seen with COVID. It's a very different disease.
Okay, now the numbers of confirmed cases of monkeypox around the world are increasing quite quickly. So far, we've got 130 confirmed cases in 18 different countries. Later on the show, we will be finding out more about how the UAE is handling monkeypox. We have got an exclusive interview with Dr. Mariam Al-Muwalla of the Abu Dhabi Public Health Centre. That will be taking place at midday today, so set your diaries for that. Meanwhile, Nadia, the UK has a lot of cases, in particular. It's quite unusual considering how far the UK is from Africa, which, of course, is where the disease is endemic. What is the count now?
Well, so far, there's been 78 confirmed cases of monkeypox in the UK. But that number, of course, can change at any moment. Sorry, excuse me. But that number, of course, can change at any moment. So experts are reassuring parents they shouldn't be worried about their children getting monkeypox, because cases in youngsters are really quite rare. So they say it's more likely that any rash is likely to be chickenpox or hand, foot and mouth disease. Professor Neil Mabbutt from the University of Edinburgh was speaking, and he says there are good tracking systems in place.
We can identify those people. If they need to be treated, they can be treated and isolated. And that way we can stop the onward chain of the disease transmission. And of course, by doing the contact tracing, we can find out where that person has been and identify other potential high-risk individuals.
Thank you very much indeed, Nadia, for that update.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
It is our regular time to do sports on the programme, but we have a special guest. It's very exciting. Hello, Robbie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
This is very unusual for me. Normally I have Mohammed, or I've got Andrew, or I've got Dane, but to have an actual off-script presenter on the radio in the morning is a very strange...
Scraping the bottom of the barrel, is that what you're trying to say? No,
not in any way at all. When we first conceived of the programme, we were like, wouldn't it be great to have off-script on every morning? And then we were firmly informed that that was not going to happen.
Absolutely delighted to join you for a few minutes to look back on a big night of sport. I stayed up quite late watching some French Open, but why don't we start by heading over to Albania and yet another trophy for the man who is indefatigable. Whatever you say about this man, whatever criticism you may level in his direction, one thing you cannot say about Jose Mourinho is that he does not deliver on the main stage. He's been in every single European final that he's participated in, Georgia. He has ended up winning the trophy, and he's now added the Europa Conference League final, Roma beating Feyenoord by a goal to nil, scored by Nicolo Zaniolo, the forward. But the story revolves, of course, around the Portuguese manager, Jose Mourinho, in Roma, his first season. It didn't get off to a great start. They were embarrassed by a low-ranking Norwegian team called Bodo Glimt all the way back in October in the group stages. They were beaten 6-1. Back in October, Georgia, and yet they've just built this confidence, they've built this momentum. The likes of Tammy Abraham, who was signed from Chelsea, Chris Smalling from Manchester United, and the former Wolves keeper Rui Patricio played a huge part in last night's final. But Roma were a sort of textbook Mourinho team. They did it 1-0, they kept their defensive lines tight, they didn't let Feyenoord through those lines, and Jose Mourinho has delivered again. It's quite astonishing, really, when you look back at his career, which began 19 years ago as the manager of Porto before he moved to Chelsea. It's the 26th trophy of his managerial career. Can you believe that? What an achievement.
He definitely isn't one to rest on his laurels, that's for sure. Meanwhile, let's turn our attentions to Liverpool boss Jurgen Klopp. Now, obviously, he's been hitting the headlines constantly. I've been learning a lot about him in my sports headlines over the last 6 months. Apparently, no concerns over his team suffering a hangover. What's meant by that? What's going on?
Well, yeah, so obviously anyone who's been keeping a keen eye on the Premier League will know that a dramatic final day on the weekend saw Manchester City come from two goals behind to beat Aston Villa 3-2. They scored three late goals all in the space of 5 minutes deep into the second half. Liverpool, meanwhile, needed to beat Wolves. They needed to beat City's results to win the Premier League title. They ended up beating Wolves by a margin of 3-1, but Manchester City's comeback meant that it was City who won the Premier League trophy by a single point. And I have to tell you, Liverpool's 92-point total would have won the league in 24 out of 29 of the English Premier League season. So that just goes to show only four teams or only four seasons, that 92-point tally, which ultimately ended second in the table, would have been topped. So with that in mind, you can understand why Jurgen Klopp's men would be a little bit disheartened. And I think we can hear from Jurgen Klopp now, Georgia.
We certainly can. Yeah, here you go.
Life gives you opportunities again and again. In this case, it's a Champions League final. So we see that nobody feels the pain from Sunday anymore. We are really just looking forward to this game against an incredible strong opponent, most experienced opponent you can probably get in this competition. But we are really looking forward.
So they're having to basically pick themselves up after that heartbreaking end and carry on because there are still plenty more championships to win, right?
Well, but if you need a pick-me-up, there's nothing better than a Champions League final and a chance to become a seven-time European Cup winner. That is what promises to be for Liverpool if they're able to overcome Real Madrid. And they are the favourites. There's no doubt Liverpool, on paper at least, are the favourites. But when you look at the runs to the final, respectively, Liverpool have had a pretty straightforward run. They beat Villarreal in the semi-finals. They beat Benfica earlier in the tournament. They were able to knock out AC Milan. Not top caliber opposition in the manner that Real Madrid were able to overcome en route to their final. They themselves had to beat Paris Saint-Germain, who we know have the likes of Neymar, have the likes of Messi, have the likes of Kylian Mbappe within their ranks. Then they beat Chelsea in that dramatic quarterfinal game. Chelsea, the defending champions of the competition. And then very, very dramatically, one of the most incredible games of football I've ever seen in the semi-final against Manchester City, where they scored twice in the last couple of minutes of normal time, Georgia, in the second leg to overturn a two-goal deficit, take it into extra time, and ultimately prevail over Manchester City, who have just won the English Premier League. So it's a really, really tough match, this. Real Madrid have this incredible confidence in the Champions League. They're 13-time winners of the tournament. They almost feel that it's their birthright to be there or thereabouts and to be picking up that trophy. But Liverpool have a fantastic history as well. And Liverpool are out for revenge after that 2018 final, which saw Real Madrid win 3-1 and saw Mo Salah go off injured early. So I cannot wait for this match. It's going to be a fitting end to what has been an amazing club football season over in Europe.
And they're kicking off at 11 p.m. this Saturday. Is that right?
Kicking off at 11 p.m. this Saturday, and for those of you who love your sport and you're out and about on Saturday, don't forget we've got a new time for extra time at the weekend on Saturday in honour of this final. We're building up to that. Tom Urquhart and his team will be down at Lock, Stock and Barrel 6 until 9 p.m. All the Champions League final build-up that you could ever possibly want will be between 6 and 9 right here on Dubai 103.8 with Tom and the team.
Okay, so my Saturday night is panning out as watching Top Gun, the new Top Gun movie, followed by, I mean, literally, it's back to back, followed by, I think I then will be required to go and watch the Champions League final. But
Don't view it as a requirement, Georgia. View it as an opportunity.
I will be flying high after Maverick, so no doubt my enthusiasm for football will be accelerated. And I'm sure it'll be a very good match as well. It's got to be right. Okay, turn our attention to tennis, because the French Open is ongoing, is it not?
Great matches last night, some fantastic matches, in fact. And I think let's start with the boy wonder, the lad they're all talking about over in men's tennis, Carlos Alcaraz, one of the favourites coming into this tournament. He's had an exceptional season so far. He's won four ATP tournaments. He's beaten the likes of Rafa Nadal on clay. He's beaten Novak Djokovic, the world number one on clay. He's just 19 years of age. He is tennis's next big thing. We've been waiting for this guy to come around with the big three's kind of era just drawing to a close as Federer hits 40 and the other two, Djokovic and Nadal, are into their mid-30s. So they can't go on forever. Tennis needs another superstar to replace them eventually. And it's clearly this man, Carlos Alcaraz. And watching his match last night against a doughty opponent in Albert Ramos Vinolas, a Spaniard who's a clay court specialist, it was a really tough match for Alcaraz. He was not at his best, but in that final set, he saved a match point in the fourth. They moved on to the fifth, and Alcaraz was producing alchemy out there on the court, Georgia. He was absolutely sensational. He hit some absurd passing shots. He made some incredible gets. His athleticism was on full display, and ultimately he ended up winning the match 6-1, 6-7, 5-7, 7-6, 6-4, which was an incredible performance. Off the back of Alexander Zverev, another top seed, a third seed here at Roland Garros, ultimately needing five sets to overcome the Argentine Sebastian Baez. It was much easier for both Rafael Nadal, the 13-time winner, of course, and Novak Djokovic, who is the defending champion. And I think we can hear Novak's thoughts.
Well, so far, so good. I'm pleased with the way I've been feeling on the court, the way I've been striking the ball, to play the way I've been playing the first two rounds. So everything is going in the right direction, and I'm looking forward to the next challenge.
Novak Djokovic, of course, hasn't been playing a great deal, has he?
Well, we had the saga down in Australia with the vaccination and the lack of thereof with Novak Djokovic. His decision to remain unvaccinated did jeopardize his schedule for sure. And when he arrived in Dubai and was knocked out early in the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championship earlier this year, he did say to reporters back then, "I just simply don't know what my schedule looks like because I don't know what tournaments I'll be eligible to play in because I'm not going to get vaccinated. That's the decision that I've made." But as it happens, the laws have been, or the regulations have been relaxed somewhat surrounding COVID and the ATP Tennis Tour. And Djokovic was able to play a fairly full clay court schedule, which culminated in his victory at the Italian Open last weekend. So he's in great form, or at least he's building up to his top form as he would try to do for these big four events. The other thing that's hanging around in the background, Georgia, and I don't want to get political on this show, probably more so than we do on Off Script.
You
we
can
really stay away from it.
Dive in. But, are you going to talk about Medvedev?
Wimbledon and the decision to ban the Russian and Belarusian players has really split the tennis world in two, really. And ATP have come back and decided to strip Wimbledon of its ranking points, which means that players who go to Wimbledon and compete there will not be earning points. It will not contribute to their season total as a whole. And some players have even dared to suggest that Wimbledon, the oldest tournament, the most grandest and prestigious of tournaments, is now nothing more than an exhibition match. An exhibition tournament. Ooh. Now, I would strongly refute that. Novak himself strongly refutes that. But it kind of depends what your situation is and perhaps how likely it is that you'll be able to make a run all the way to the final there. So that's really got the tennis world talking, and we'll wait to see how that one is resolved. But for now, Novak is in the French Open. He's making serene progress, as you'd expect. He's in form, having won in Italy last week. And you can bet your bottom dollar that he and Rafael Nadal will probably have to face off at some point because they're in the same side of the draw.
Wow, that will be really exciting. Really exciting stuff. OK, let's turn our attention very briefly to the IPL, a bit of cricket. What's going on there?
Well, what's going on there is that Virat Kohli may yet win a first IPL with Royal Challengers Bangalore. After years of underachievement, Georgia, they were successful last night over the Lucknow Super Giants in the first eliminator, if you like. They moved through to the second qualifier where they will face the Rajasthan Royals, the winner of which will meet the Gujarat Titans in Sunday's final. Gujarat are a new franchise, as were the Lucknow Super Giants. We know Royal Challengers Bangalore and Virat Kohli have been knocking on the door for a long time, and it was great to see that they finally made the breakthrough. And the star man was someone you wouldn't have expected. When you've got a team boasting Virat Kohli, Saf du Plessis, Glenn Maxwell, you're expecting the runs to come from those guys. You're not perhaps expecting them to come from a guy called Rajat Patidar, but he did. He hit a sublime century off just 54 balls. RCB, the Royal Challengers, they posted 207 for the loss of four wickets, and that was enough to get past the Lucknow Super Giants. They've got to get one past one more match, the Rajasthan Royals. That one takes place on Friday, and the winner of that will meet the Gujarat Titans in Sunday's final. After quite some time, the IPL is finally rumbling to a dramatic conclusion, Georgia.
Fantastic. Plenty of cricket to look forward to this weekend then. Robbie, I'm afraid you're going to get regular phone calls now. The use of the word doughty, I like that. Alchemy, a sublime century. I mean, basically, you've just talked yourself into a regular spot on the agenda. I fear.
That was my intention all along, Georgia.
I'm sure it was, but you are at risk of very regular phone calls, I'm afraid. So thank you very, very much indeed. We'll look forward to hearing your wonderful voice again on the radio this afternoon at 5. Is that right? It is right.
Thank you.
I know it's right. Thank you very much indeed. Robbie Greenfield, not often you get to hear him twice in one day, but an absolute pleasure to have him, his guest appearance here on the agenda. Let's hope it's the first, but very much not the last time.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Now, all this week, we've been covering stories coming out of the World Economic Forum gathering in Davos in Switzerland. World leaders and the business elite have come together to discuss the major issues of the day. Now, one journalist who's been covering the conference is CNN correspondent Julia Chatterley. I spoke to her earlier and I asked her whether there had been any standout speeches during the forum.
The most important speech, once again, was President Zelensky, because he cut to the core of everything that's being discussed here today, not just the short-term impact that the war in Ukraine is having and the consequences for the global economy, but of course, beyond that, the longer-term challenges that we face, be it climate change, be it food security, and the impact that that's having. So there's not one leader and not one nation represented here that isn't impacted to a lesser or to a greater extent by what we're seeing there. One of the other big takeaways, of course, is that Russia isn't represented here and very few Chinese. So at a time when actually we need the global world order to come together more than ever to solve some of the biggest crises in the world, perhaps we could argue we're more fractured than ever. So there's highs and lows at this Davos, I think, and clearly real concern about where we're headed and really high uncertainty.
I mean, you touched on a couple of the sort of major themes and issues just then, but what does seem to be dominating the main conversations, both on stages and, of course, importantly, off the stages in all those networking events?
It's interesting. The IMF chief came here with an incredibly strong message and said, look, we are facing the biggest test of the global economy since the Second World War, and yet most business leaders I've spoken to, I just spoke to the Volkswagen CEO and he has a giant global business. And he said, look, it's not that bad. And the consumer's holding up. We have challenges. We have a cost of living crisis. We have energy security issues, food security issues, but it's not that bad. And we've had bigger crises. So tinged with the concern and the uncertainty were those that were saying, actually, don't panic about what we're seeing out there, which I think is an important message to come away from, because we don't want to scare people and perhaps have some kind of confidence crisis amid a great deal of uncertainty. But of course, the underlying challenges remain. And I think one of the crucial issues that people are afraid about is that in the short term, that you make decisions that are wrong for the long term. In the short term, you ramp up production of food, as an example, and you do it in an unsustainable way. And that makes farmers around the world poor, or energy security. You make short-term decisions in order to protect your people and not mean that they face incredibly high energy costs. But again, the consequences for the climate. So are we short-term trying to shore our defences at the long-term consequences for the global economy? And as always, and it's an important discussion here, and we always have it and we always should, it's the poorest people in the world that suffer most for all of these decisions. And I think we feel that more keenly than ever.
Gosh, you get a sense there of the sort of grand scale on which these discussions are taking place. You know, it's really, really big picture stuff. And I suppose it doesn't get much more big picture than global climate change. And obviously, we're all looking ahead to COP27, which is due to take place in Egypt, or at least we were all looking ahead to it. And then, of course, global events slightly took over. You know, the war in Ukraine, the markets started crashing. Do you think there is still a focus on climate change, that there is still a drive to deal with global warming?
I think more than ever before, there is recognition that we have no choice. We can't sideline the importance of, one, focusing on the impact that we're having on our planet, because it has a dramatic impact and has been for years on our people. And you can't separate food security and our global food system from the impact that we have on the climate. 30%, or a third actually now, of our global greenhouse gases come from our food system. So if you try and tackle, let's be optimistic, solve food security crisis, you're already addressing your ambitions for climate change and going a long way, let's be clear, to doing that. And I think really for the first time, because of the war in Ukraine and because of how acute the challenge and the food security issue is, we're suddenly starting to connect the dots. I spoke to the head of the World Food Programme, David Beasley, here, and he said to me, look, 831 million people are going to go hungry tonight. And I'm making decisions to take food from hungry people around the world and give it to people that are near starving. He's like, these are excruciating decisions. And I think a lot of the conversations here have been, why is the World Food Programme on the front lines here? Why aren't they the last line of defence? And how do we go in the short term and in the longer term to address that challenge? And this is important. At least we're having the conversations. It's not enough, but at least we're now having them.
I did note that the global food security crisis has been a main theme at the conference, but there's also been some interesting news lines surrounding that coming out, not least the suggestion from the CIA that Russia is blockading the Ukrainian port. Is that something that you guys have been reporting on?
It is. And also, again, that the head of the World Food Programme has said there has to be a global solution to opening the ports in Ukraine. There also has to be strong considerations for those companies that are being criticised, the likes of Syngenta, fertilizer company that's continuing to trade with Russia. Because I think what we also have to understand is we can't feed the world and we're going to have a more acute crisis if we don't continue to trade with Russia with their fertilizer. And we need their grain. It's not great. It's like the energy security crisis that we are so reliant on Russia. This part of the world is the breadbasket. But tough decisions have to be made. There is a war going on in Ukraine. There is a bigger war, I think, going on in terms of food security. And again, these discussions are being had. There are no easy decisions on any of this, whether it's maximum sanctions on Russia, whether it's continuing to trade with Russia in certain sectors like agriculture. And I think one of the strongest messages to come out of this is unintended consequences. The World Food Programme chief said to me, be careful that the decisions that you make in terms of sanctions on Russia don't end up hurting you more. And I think he said it best when he said, not allowing those ports to be opened is a declaration of war on global food security. He also said Putin's legacy could end up being global famine. These were really strong lines. If Putin doesn't want to end the war for other reasons, for humanitarian reasons, as we'd like, quite frankly, how about that for a legacy? Creating a situation where we have a global famine. So these are the kind of cut to the core, heart type of decisions and conversations that I've been having. They're profound.
That was Julia Chatterley, who's a correspondent for CNN, who has been covering the World Economic Forum this week. A new report has come out about the accidents on the roads of the UAE. A total of 381 people died last year in those road accidents. And that figure is from the Ministry of Interior. It's 27 more fatalities than reported in 2020. So we are asking the question, could we be going back to the pre-pandemic road madness? To crunch the numbers and tell us what caused those road deaths, we're joined on the line now by Thomas Adelman. He is, of course, the founder of Road Safety UAE, and he joins me now on Microsoft Teams. Hi, Thomas, how are you?
Hello, good morning. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I'm very interested to hear about the details around these figures, these road accidents. I imagine you have never been in a road accident yourself, I presume.
Well, as a matter of fact, I have been in two major road traffic accidents in my younger years. Luckily, nothing happened. There were two very serious accidents, so it can happen to anyone. A couple of years ago, we had Niki Lauda, who's a Formula One driver and a 2-time world champion. He talked about that and he said, listen, guys, it even happened to him as a very, very experienced driver. So we are not better than anyone else. So even super experienced drivers can run into accidents. Yeah? So it happens. It can happen to you, unfortunately, to me, to everybody. And that's the reason why we can never let our guards down.
Can you tell me how many accidents occurred in the UAE last year? This is the sort of number of accidents in total, not the deadly ones, but the number of accidents.
Well, the number of accidents that we have seen last year were about 3,500. So it's just below that. So it's 3,488. So these are accidents that result either in injuries or in fatalities. And you touched earlier on the magic number, the most important number, the hardest hitting KPI, so to say, which is the number of fatalities on our roads. And yes, it's 381. And yes, it's an increase from last year. Actually, we have to always compare a little bit. The data that we're talking about is 2021 data. So not this year's data. So it's from the full year 2021, because the authorities, they take a couple of months to aggregate all the data. So we are comparing 2021 data, which are just hot off the press, against 2020 data. And there, yes, we see an increase about 27, or from 354 to 381. However, we may not forget that 2021 was the COVID year, and we saw a lot less traffic than before. So I think it's a much better comparison to go, as you also recommended, pre-COVID. And then the last year, pre-COVID, 2019, where we saw more or less a full year of normal traffic, we had 448 fatalities. Now, 448 in 2019, and now we have 381 in 2021. So it's a further decrease in the number of fatalities.
So that's why we have to break down these figures with you in so much detail, because actually the figures are actually getting better in many ways, because that year of 2020 kind of, you know, we have to sort of discount it in nearly all surveys. You know, when everyone's talking about economic surveys, they go, yeah, 2020, we kind of ignore that. And then now in traffic accidents, we have to sort of ignore it. Their crime, we have to ignore it. I mean, out of these accidents that did take place, does the ministry sort of break it down to what are considered serious accidents, and what qualifies a serious accident, rather than just sort of a little bump when someone sort of shunts somebody else?
Yes. I mean, first of all, a big compliment to the authorities. I've been here in the UAE for 22 years. I'm running Road Safety UAE for 8 years. And in this span of 8 years, we see a lot more transparency when it comes to sharing data. But obviously, ARN and Business Breakfast and what you guys are doing with the agenda, it's always about talking about numbers, talking about figures and facts, and not just about anecdotal evidence. So insofar, we have to give a big compliment to the authorities. They give us much more information than ever before. And going back to your question, so what qualifies as an accident, as a major accident? It is basically when somebody gets injured. Yes, you have the fender bender. These things would not qualify under these accidents. So if somebody gets injured, then these accidents basically count as major accidents. And again, last year we had a number of 3,488. Now, when you break that up, we had in these 3,488 accidents, we had 4,377 injuries. Yeah, because some of the accidents, they result in more than one injury. And then when you look at that, the biggest chunk of injuries are medium injuries, which are more than 2,200. We have kind of, as the ministry refers to, simple injuries, which is about 1,700 injuries. And then we have more than 400 severe injuries. And again, we have then on top of that, unfortunately, also 381 fatalities.
Does the ministry, in that fantastic sort of data that they now release, do they reveal the causes of the accidents and fatalities? Things like lane swerving or tailgating or entering a street before it's clear. Do they break things down in that way?
Yes, absolutely. And you're spot on. You mentioned four of the top five causes of accidents. Again, compliment to the authorities that they are really going the extra mile to share more details with us and with the broader public. This is all public information, by the way. Everybody can look into this data. And just to bring things to life, the top five causes of accidents, the top five causes of misbehavior, because we can never forget, it's you and me misbehaving on the roads. Yeah, so the top five of those forms of misbehavior account for more than 60% of all accidents. I just get that. It's just five things. They account for more than 60% of all accidents. Number one, it's a hit over all those years. It has always been the number one, which with quite a big margin, is lane swerving. So people changing the lane suddenly without indicating, just leaving the lane, bumping into others, cutting across multiple lanes. So this sudden deviation, this lane swerving, again, number one cause of accidents in the UAE. Clearly avoidable. The second one, as avoidable as the first one, is tailgating. So people are just driving too close to the vehicle in front. Yeah, so we see about 14% of all accidents caused by the misbehavior of tailgating. Point number three is then being distracted. Now, so we all know we are on the phones a lot. You see a lot of people on the phones doing whatever they are doing on the phones, which is not only breaking the law, but it's also resulting in clearly avoidable accidents. So 13% of all accidents are going to the account of motorists being distracted. And then you also talked about that number four is about entering a street without checking if it's clear. Super avoidable also. We look left, we look right, and only if there's no other vehicle, we're gonna pull out into traffic. So just below 10% of all accidents are caused by this misbehavior of entering a road before checking if it's actually clear. And then number five on the list, it's called neglect and inattention. Yeah, so we are just all over with our thoughts. We're just not paying attention to what's happening. And this is the number five on the list with about 9% of all accidents caused by this form of misbehavior. And again, you know, it's a good old wisdom. We say more than 90%, actually more around 95% of all accidents are caused by human error, by misbehavior. And in the context of the UAE, once again, I'm not tired reminding listeners on that. Just five causes of misbehavior are resulting in more than 60% of all accidents.
Thomas, I've only got about a minute left with you, and I really want to ask you obviously this is something you've been studying for more than 8 years, the state of the roads of the UAE. Is your feel that they're getting safer or that the opposite is true?
No, for sure they're getting safer. Again, and it's not about anecdotal evidence, it's about figures and facts, and the hardest hitting KPI, not only in the UAE but also worldwide, is just like how many people are dying in a country on the roads in road traffic. And there we have a remarkable positive trend. And again, we talked about the short-term trend over the last couple of years, but just to wrap that up maybe, 10 years ago, in the year 2011, we had 720 fatalities, and now in 2021, we have 381. But just compare that, 720 going down to 381. I think there are not many countries in the world that have such a fantastic development. I think the authorities are doing the right things. The media are doing the right thing. You are also tirelessly kind of hammering down on the importance of road safety, raising awareness for road safety. There are many like-minded companies, many big organizations that look after their staff. They're doing the right things. And also road users. I think they're getting more and more about, yeah, we have to look after our own safety, about the safety of our passengers and everybody around us. So I think all the involved stakeholders are cruising in the right direction. And last but not least, you know, it's the hardest hitting KPI that we have. Not only in the UAE, but globally. And the UAE is doing a great job.
Thomas Adelman, founder and of Road Safety UAE, thank you very much for crunching those figures with us. We always appreciate your time. It's fantastic to see you again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting interview there. And of course, lots of comments coming through on 4001. Uli, who has actually written in on our WhatsApp number 0487155500. He says, "Hi, Georgia. More importantly, most people do not use indicators." Now, I'm sure that's something that Thomas Adelman has noticed as well.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, one of the major things that we're going to be discussing as to how you can avoid road fatalities, how you can reduce that number. Because, of course, We need to solve the roads problems and prevent these traffic-related deaths. Now, we're going to speak now to an insurance company who says they can potentially help with turning bad drivers into good drivers. Joining me on the line now is Indraneel Jain. He is the Chief Business Officer at Bima. Hi there, Indraneel. How are you? Thank you for joining us on Teams.
Hi, Georgia. And first of all, good morning. Good morning. Good morning to all your listeners and really happy to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Now, I know that you guys have a theory that the less you drive, the less you are likely to cause an accident. And as a consequence, you sort of change your policies accordingly. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Bima is an innovative market-driven insurance provider in the UAE, and we serve the customers and are committed towards making safe driving a norm in the region. Bima's vision is to sort of make insurance livable, which is not an easy topic or a task. No one wants to discuss insurance first thing in the morning. But we want to be in line with the UAE's national agenda, which is to reduce the rate of road traffic accidents. And Bima is committed to promoting and creating social awareness around safe driving through its products like Pay Per Kilometer, which rewards customers for less driving, and Payback, cash back for unutilized policy amount, as well as Bima Smart Driver, which is a latest technology that assesses smart driving or safe driving through measured data points like braking, speeding, phone handling. We are able to kind of gauge what sort of levels of safe driving the driver is having through the year. And if the driver turns out to be a safe driver, reward the customers at the end of the day through cash back or rewards, so that we are inculcating the habit of safe driving in the users and drivers.
So I would never have thought that insurance companies could help in the sort of campaign for road safety. But it emerges that, you know, I think if you hit somebody in the pocket, you know, if they're a bad driver and you can tell that through your smart devices and therefore their premiums go up, that is going to make people want to drive safer, I guess.
Yes, that's correct. And of course, I mean, if people start believing in the idea that, you know, if I just inculcate a bit of safe driving behavior, I'm going to get rewarded for it, then why not? Everyone loves cashback. Everyone loves to be rewarded for something that they are putting an effort behind. And safe driving is something that not only helps them monetarily, but also towards the safety of their families. So why not? I think by just downloading the Bima app, you can start tracking your driving skills, behaviors, earn points on every trip, and see how well you're driving. And it is a live monitor. And at the end of the day, you're getting rewarded for it.
Okay, so how about customers who are a bit like, but you're spying on me?
So we, at Bima, we use the highest levels of GDPR as well as cybersecurity measures. And that's why we don't ask the customers to install any black box or any tracking device. We only have an app which is protected against any and all sorts of issues, data privacy issues. And what we do is only measure the driving behaviors. So you're not sharing any trip details. You're not sharing any personal information. All you're doing is just tracking your driving behavior.
So we've just heard, I mean, literally the figures are literally hot off the press, that there were 3,488 accidents in 2021 and 381 deaths. Are the claims that you're receiving reflecting that, or do you think your drivers are better drivers?
No, like any other insurance company would say so, but I beg to differ here. So Bima, because of its products, are, you know, sort of not in line with these figures. And in fact, our claims ratios are lower, are closest to the lowest in the industry, if not the low, if not lower. Our drivers are safer drivers. Our drivers are conscious drivers. I don't know if they were before, but certainly after using Bima's products, they have become safer. And we have seen a pattern where customers are inculcating these habits and are becoming more and more conscious about their scores. So they would start off, let's say, on a score of 5, and they strive to go to a score of 9, thereby making them safer drivers, which only helps us to have lesser claims.
do you know, it's really deliciously circular and it's sort of beneficially circular, which so I really like that idea. You know, you drive safer, you get your premiums come down, and then everyone's safe on the roads. Isn't that a brilliant scenario? Thank you so much for your time, Indranil. It sounds like a brilliant policy, and I hope lots of people sign up for it.
Thanks, Georgia, and you're doing a wonderful job on your show.
Thank
Happy
you.
To be on your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can come back anytime if you're going to say that. Thank you very much indeed. Indranil Jain is the Chief Business Officer at Bima. Really interesting to hear there from both Thomas Edelman, the road safety expert, and also Indranil Jain there from Bima. And we did get those figures hot off the press. Zina is in touch with Thomas on a regular basis. So we are one of the first news organisations to get those figures that show that there were 3,488 accidents in 2021 and 381 deaths. Thank you so much for your messages coming through about road safety. People are messaging on WhatsApp 0487155500. This person says using the phones while driving is the main reason for accidents in their view. The fines are just not high enough to scare people off. And Uli says, most important, most people do not use indicators and that is causing issues.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, information about the victims of the gas blast in Abu Dhabi on Monday are starting to emerge. A gas cylinder exploded at a restaurant in Khalidia, killing two people and injuring around 120. Zina Zalameya has been following the story and joins me now in the studio.
Thanks, Georgia. Here's what we know. India's embassy in the Emirates said one of its citizens was killed and 106 of its country's citizens are injured in the accident. Now, officials said urgent medical care is being provided to those injured in six hospitals across Abu Dhabi and that it's closely monitoring the condition of the injured. Now, Pakistan's embassy has also issued a statement saying that the other person killed was a Pakistani citizen, that 18 of its citizens were injured in the incident. So no figures have come out yet from the Philippine embassy, but I've been speaking to a Filipino expat here, one of those injured, not really injured, but he has witnessed the accident and his flat is right across the street from the blast. He's been living in Abu Dhabi since 2014. You know, he's felt safe here until this particular incident, and he was at work about 12 buildings away from the blast. He's now being put up in a hotel because his flat has been completely damaged. I was able to speak to him, and here's what he can remember from that day.
The explosion happened around 12:40 to 1. There were actually two blasts. The first one was not that loud. The second one was just too loud. We gathered there near in the window to see what was happening. The blast came from near our building. We saw this white smoke everywhere. There are glass debris, and my roommate actually went there before I did. He saw these people on the ground, cuts in their heads and all over their body. There are lots of debris. Many people are seriously injured at that time.
Okay, and that was what you heard and saw 12 buildings away from where the blast actually happened. Or you were working somewhere in a location that was 12 buildings away, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was really loud. I can't imagine if that happened and we were in the building. I don't know what will happen. I live in the building, in the front of the building where it exploded, in the third floor.
Can you describe what happened to your building and particularly your flat?
Well, our building, the entrance door was broken. The ceilings were down. We went upstairs after 2 days.
You were allowed then, upstairs to go to your flat after two days after the blast.
To get something, important things and clothes, because we were not able to get anything from that day when the explosion happened. So on the second day, we asked permission to the policeman and to the people there, and then they allowed us to go inside. But there's no electricity, there's no water, the flats are open.
I imagine, you know, the authorities or search and rescue teams already cleared the site of the explosion.
Yes, they cleared the site of the explosion when that happened until today.
They're still cleaning.
Yeah, they're still cleaning. But some of the affected buildings, some of the tenants were already there now. They came back since yesterday and today. But our building, the nearest building where the explosion happened, we're not allowed to live there and go back there for now. When we ask them, they will extend us in the hotel. They will give us another day and we will wait for until further notice. That's what they said.
Okay, so you are being put up in a hotel. So hopefully you'll be able to check out today. Otherwise, maybe you'll be spending another day there. And then you can go home at the weekend. Is that right?
Yeah. They just wanted us to wait for another day or to wait for another notice from the government if we can go back to our building.
The hotel stay is free and the food is free. So you're being looked after.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You saw the scene from afar. How did you feel? I hope you're okay now.
Well, actually I'm fine. But my friends, some of the people I know that were there near the explosion, they were like shocked and they are afraid to go back. But they can't do anything because now we can just transfer to a new place because it's all the same. There's all gas in all the buildings. When the explosion happened and then when we went here to the hotel in our first day, when we waited for our room to be given to us, we talked about the explosion. There were people are shocked about what happened. There are kids who are keep on saying there's fire, there's blast, and they're afraid to go back there.
Are you afraid to go back to your apartment or do you think it'll be fine?
I am actually hesitant to go back, but I can't do anything about it. The things that we keep on talking about is when we'll be coming back in our building, how can we, you know, get our things if it's not allowed to go back, and how can we, you know, go to our work because some of their works are far from the hotels that we are living.
So, Jeffrey, you are unharmed. No problems with your ears, respiratory problems. Are people checking on you? Are there authorities coming to the hotel and just following up on your experience, looking after you or asking what else you need?
The first day, there was one representative from the embassy, Philippine embassy, as far as I remember.
Well, all the best, Jeffrey. Please let us know when you're back in your apartment. One of the things I'd like to ask you is, do you have a gas cylinder at home?
We use this gas from the building. Actually, the owner of the flat asked the owner of the building if it's really safe to have that. And they said they will keep on checking every time.
And lastly, Jeffrey, obviously this made headlines globally. Did your family ask about you when they learned about the explosion? Did you call them or did they get in touch with you? Were they worried?
Yeah, they were worried. They know that I live in that place. They immediately contacted me. I just told them that I wasn't at work when the explosion happened. I was far from that blast, so I am okay. Though I'm just a little bit hesitant to go back for now.
That's Jeffrey. He is an Abu Dhabi resident and he's one of those people being put up in a hotel because his flat is directly across the street from the site of the explosion.
Absolutely amazing to be able to hear his testimony and the effect that this blast has had on his mental health, really. I know that he wasn't personally injured by the blast. And obviously, it was a serious thing. 120 people were injured, 2 people killed. But it gives you a sense of the sort of other repercussions of this incident, you know, because people living in the area, you know, their homes have been damaged, they've been disrupted, and they've basically been frightened by it.
Exactly. And they don't really know when their flats will be repaired. And even if they move to another place, his concern is that there's the fear that, you know, it's a flat full of gas cylinders as well. So he now has that phobia of gas cylinders and what might happen if people misuse them.
Completely understandable. Huge thanks to Zina and, of course, Milani, who also helped secure that interview with Jeffrey, because I think it's really important to hear these stories, the various different stories from people, because this was a big deal. This was a big explosion. It really will have shaken a lot of people living in Abu Dhabi.
Yes, and we will be following this story, you know, as people recover from their injuries and as Jeffrey goes back to his flat, they will be sharing their stories moving forward.
Okay, speaking on our program yesterday, Abu Dhabi resident Ahmad, who lives close by, also described what he saw from his window during the explosion.
So I'm laying in bed and I'm sick, and that's when I heard an alarmingly loud blast.
blasts. And I immediately jump out and I go to the window to see what's happening. And I see people coming out and trying to see, you know, what's up. That's when a few minutes later, I start seeing white smoke come out of behind one of the buildings across the street, you know. And then a few minutes later, I started hearing like police sirens, fire trucks, and even like a bit after, a helicopter came.
We also spoke yesterday to fire safety expert Gary Sherrington Boyd from Rotorex FireTech, who provided complete fire protection, or who provide complete fire protection systems for companies. Now, he told me that gas cylinder safety is a shared responsibility.
There is a team within the civil defense that do spot checks. The restaurant owner and the building owner does have to take quite a lot of responsibility on this themselves. And my building is very stringent. They've got their own civil defense approved engineers on site for emergency, and the contractor that they use to come in and install the cylinders, supply the cylinders, and to maintain the cylinders are also all civil defense approved.
That is Gary Sherrington Boyd from Rotorex FireTech, giving us a little bit of reassurance there on how you can ensure that you stay safe when it comes to gas cylinders. It was a really interesting interview with Gary, actually. If you want to listen back to it, then please do. It's on our podcast. Just go to dubaieye1038.com, and then you can check out the Agenda's webpage, and that was where you'll find the podcast. But he was really interesting about how you can stay safe. He pointed out that this incident probably happened because there was a large gas cylinder on site for the restaurant on the ground floor, probably one of the last sort of big gas cylinders, about sort of 5 feet tall. And as a consequence, that's why the blast was so big. And, you know, you wouldn't see that type of effect from a smaller gas cylinder, the type that you or I might have at our villa or in our apartment.
That's reassuring.
It is reassuring. He also said that if you want to check the safety of your gas cylinder, then to check there aren't any leaks, for example, then you can get a little system that goes that you put in on the wall in your kitchen or in your apartment that shows whether there's a gas leak. That's an early warning system. Or you can just use soapy water. And if you just put soapy water around the valve and around the pipe, if there's any leaks, then it will bubble and you'll be able to see the bubbles. So really good advice there from Gary Sherrington Boyd.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Now, our smartphones are apparently changing the shape of our bodies. So that's the message, the worrying message from the Australian Chiropractors Association, who say that our compulsive use of mobile devices are doing damage to our necks. Joining us now to talk through that story and much more is, of course, Kevin Sebastian, our tech correspondent. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm quite well. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Lovely to speak to you. We've got a busy show today. Nothing a journalist likes more than a breaking news story, and we're getting one out of Qatar at the moment. But in the meantime, let's talk about what's going on with our bodies and our mobile phones.
So there's been very credible research to suggest that our phones are contributing to what is called text neck, which is pretty much identified as an ailment back in 2011. And being one of those people who are always on their phones, when I hit my 30s, I've realized how painful this can be. Just to give a bit of a context to this, the more you look at your phone over time and the way you angle your head to look at your phone, because our heads are not designed to constantly look down at long periods of time. Even when you look at PCs or our laptops, you're still looking somewhat straight, if not on a downward sloping motion. But when you're looking at your phone, you're literally looking all the way down. This is causing issues with people's spines, and this can lead to long-term posture problems, which can get very serious later on, because the act of even putting your head for long durations of time means you're stressing about 27 kilograms, depending on how big your head is, of weight onto your spine.
Depending on how big your head is. I love that. What's great, though, is I've just read that there's one thing that you can do to avoid it, right? And I've just been doing it now. I don't know if we're on video or not, but apparently you need to do a simple stretch where you interlock your fingers behind your head and hold your elbows against a wall. Well, I haven't got a wall, but I've got my hands above my head. Do you think that's what you do?
Yeah. No, I actually have a backrest on my chair. So, because I'm in the nature of my work, I know that I will be sitting for extended hours at end. But at the same time, I do take at least a good 4 to 5 hours of a break without looking at any displays. And that's a standard procedure for everything. That's including my phone as well.
So do you know, I'm doing it now. Yeah. It's hurting. It's hurting across the front. I think it's literally hurting across the front of my shoulders. I think I've got it. I think I've got tech neck. Tech neck, whatever it's called.
Tech neck, yeah. Tech neck. So a lot of chiropractors here, even in Dubai, actually have a lot of cases where people's necks and shoulders are super stiff. And if you're listening on the show and you definitely need, if you feel like you've been having a stiff neck, definitely go to a good chiropractor, because they're going to tell you the same thing. Get off your screens for at least a few hours a day, because you're stressing out your back. And our bodies are not designed biologically to look that long anyway. And it's a very weird stage for evolution as to how our bodies will evolve, because, again, kids are young as 10 years old are looking at iPads and looking at smaller displays.
You know
well.
Where we went wrong? We shouldn't have got rid of tails. If we had tails now, we'd be able to use our tails to hold the phone, and we'd be able to hold it at a reasonable height, because if we had nice long tails, like, you know, the sort of lemur type ones, they could come round. And also it would mean that if you're on the metro, you could use your tail to hold on while you're on the metro, and then you'd have two hands to read the newspaper, for example.
It's very interesting you bring that up, because I'm 100% sure in about 10 years from now, people are going to develop an exoskeleton which will actually have that same principle, where you have a tail holding your devices for you.
I want an exo-tail. Do you know, we've got about 30 seconds to do the next topic, because I decided to talk about tails. What's going on with Instagram? They've changed their font or something?
Very quickly, Instagram's actually going through a very subtle brand rechange. If people haven't seen it already, it's very subtle. The colors are much more popped, and Instagram have changed their font. A lot of people are not a fan of it because it's got a very futuristic font to it. It's called Instagram Sans. Which Instagram have says they call it the Squircle, because it's the rounded square version of its logo. So you within the next couple of days, everyone should get to see these typefaces on stories and reels. Whether or not I'm a fan, it's regardless to say, because at the end of the day, it's how you use the platform that matters, and not really small changes like this.
Very interesting stuff. Actually, my Instagram's done something weird. On just one of my accounts, my professional account, it's now blurred all the stories together rather than having a nice gap in between. And I don't know how to change it. So that's been annoying me. I'll talk to you about it later, but it's annoying me. Kevin, Sebastian, as ever, thank you so much for that update. Really appreciate your time. And we look forward to speaking to you same time next week, if you're free. Are you free?
Likewise, I am.
Amazing. Kevin Sebastian, tech correspondent to the stars, i.e. us, and probably lots of other publications. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.